Side 13. November 1st. A new month. And new luck. The tunnel idea keeps nagging at me, but the difficulty till now has been something to dig the concrete out with. Then yesterday, as I was doing my prison exercise in the outer cellar, I saw a nail. A big, old one, down against the wall in the far corner. I dropped my handkerchief so that I could get a closer look. I couldn't pick it up. He watches me so closely. And it's awkward with bound hands. Then today, when I was by the nail, he always sits on the steps up. I did it on purpose. Run and get me a cigarette. They're on the chair by the door. Of course he wouldn't. He said, what's the game? I'll stay here. I won't move. Why don't you get them yourself? Because sometimes I like to remember the days when men were nice to me, that's all. I didn't think it would work, but it did. He suddenly decided that there wasn't anything I could possibly do, nothing I could pick up. He locks things away in a drawer when I come out here. So he went through the door, only a second. But I stooped like lightning and got the nail up and into my skirt pocket. Specially put on. I was standing exactly as he left me when he jumped back. So I got my nail. And made him think he could trust me. Two birds with one stone. Nothing. But it seems a tremendous victory. I've started putting my plan into effect. For days I've been telling Caliban that I don't see why D and M and everyone else should be left in the dark about whether I still exist. At least he could tell them I'm alive and all right. Tonight after supper, I told him he could buy paper from Woolworths and use gloves and so on. He tried to wriggle out of it as usual, but I kept at him. Every objection I squashed, and in the end, I felt he really was beginning to think he might do it for me. I told him he could post the letter in London to put the police off the track, and that I wanted all sorts of things from London. I've got to get him away from here for at least 3 or 4 hours because of the burglar alarms, and then I'm going to try my tunnel. What I've been thinking is that as the walls of the cellar and the outer ones are stone, not stone, then behind the stones there must be earth. All I have to do is to get through the skin of stones, and then I shall be in soft earth, I imagine. Perhaps it's all wild, but I'm in a fever to try it. The Nielsen woman. I'd met her twice more at GP's, when there were other people there. One was her husband, a Dane, some kind of importer. He spoke perfect English, so perfect it sounded wrong, affected. I met her one day when she was coming out of the hairdresser's, and I'd been in to make an appointment for Caroline. She had on that special queasy bright look women like her put on for girls of my age. What Minnie calls welcome to the tribe of women. It means they're going to treat you like a grown-up, but they don't really think you are, and anyhow they're jealous of you. She would take me for coffee. I was silly, I should have lied. It was all rhubarb about me, about her daughter, about art. She knows people and tried to dazzle me with names. But it's what people feel about art that I respect, not what or who they know. I know she can't be a lesbian, but she clings like that to one's words. Things in her eyes she doesn't dare tell you, but wants you to ask her to. You don't know what's gone on and what still goes on between GP and me, she seemed to say. I dare you to ask me. She talked on and on about Charlotte Street in the late 30s and the war. Dylan Thomas, GP. He likes you, she said. I know, I answered. But it was a shock. Both that she knew, had he told her, and that she wanted to discuss it. I know she did. He's always fallen for the really pretty ones, she said. She wanted terribly to discuss it. Then it was her daughter. She said, she's 16 now. I just can't get across to her. Sometimes when I talk to her, I feel like an animal in a zoo. She just stands outside and watches me. I knew she'd said it before. Or read it somewhere. You can always tell. They're all the same, women like her. It's not the teenagers and daughters who are different. We haven't changed. We're just young. It's the silly new middle-aged people who've got to be young who've changed. This desperate silly trying to stay with us. They can't be with us. We don't want them to be with us. We don't want them to wear our clothes styles and use our language and have our interests. They imitate us so badly that we can't respect them. But it made me feel, that meeting with her, that GP did love me, want me. That there's a deep bond between us. His loving me in his way, My liking him very much, even loving him, but not sexually, in my way. A feeling that we're groping towards a compromise. A sort of fog of unsolved desire and sadness between us. Something other people, like the N-woman, couldn't ever understand. Two people in a desert, trying to find both themselves and an oasis where they can live together. I've begun to think more and more like this. It's terribly cruel of fate to put these 20 years between us. Why couldn't he be my age, or me his? So the age thing is no longer the all-important factor that puts love right out of the question, but a sort of cruel wall fate has built between us. I don't think any more the wall is between us. I think the wall keeps us apart. November 2nd. He produced the paper after supper and dictated an absurd letter that I had to write out. And then the trouble started. I had prepared a little note, written in my smallest writing, and I slipped it into the envelope when he wasn't looking. It was very small, and in the best spy stories wouldn't have been noticed. He did. It upset him, made him see things in the cold light of reality. But he was genuinely shocked that I should be frightened. He can't imagine himself killing or raping me, and that is something. I let him have his pet, but in the end I went and tried to be nice to him, because I knew I must get him to send that letter. It was a job. I've never known him in such a huff. Wouldn't he call it a day and let me go home? No. What did he want to do with me then? Take me to bed? He gave me such a look, as if I was being really disgusting. Then I had an inspiration. I acted a little charade. His Oriental slave. He likes me to play the fool. The stupidest things I do he calls witty. He's even got in the habit of joining in, stumbling after me, not that I'm very dazzling, like a giraffe. So I got him to let me write another letter. He looked in the envelope again. Then I talked him into going to London, as my plan requires. I gave him a ridiculous list of things, most of them I don't want, but it'll keep him busy to buy. I told him it was impossible to trace a letter posted in London, so he finally agreed. He likes me to wheedle, the brute. One request. No, I don't ask him for things. I ordered them. I commanded him to try and buy a George Paston. I gave him a list of galleries where he might find things by GP. I even tried to get him to go to the studio. But as soon as he heard it was in Hampstead, he smelt a rat. He wanted to know if I knew this George Paston. I said no, well, just by name. But it didn't sound very convincing. And I was afraid he wouldn't buy any of his pictures anywhere. So I said, he's a casual friend of mine. He's quite old, but he's a very good painter. And he badly needs money, and I should very much like some of his pictures. We could hang them on the wall. If you bought straight from him, he wouldn't be paying money to the galleries. But I can see you're frightened to go, I said. So there's an end to it. Of course, he didn't fall for that. He wanted to know if GP was one of those paint-pot-at-the-wall chaps. I just gave him a look. I was only joking. Then don't. After a bit, he said, he would want to know where I came from and all. I told him what he could say, and he said he'd think about it, which is Calibanese for no. It was too much to expect. And there probably won't be anything in any of the galleries. And I don't worry, because I'm not going to be here this time tomorrow. I'm going to escape. He'll go off after breakfast. He's going to leave my lunch. So I shall have 4 or 5 hours... unless he cheats and doesn't get all I've asked. But he's never failed before. I felt sorry for Caliban this evening. He will suffer when I'm gone. There'll be nothing left. He'll be alone with all his sex neuroses and his class neuroses and his uselessness and his emptiness. He's asked for it. I'm not really sorry. But I'm not absolutely unsorry. November 4th. I couldn't write yesterday. Too fed up. I was so stupid. I got him away all yesterday. I had hours to escape. But I never really thought of the problems. I saw myself scooping out handfuls of soft, loamy earth. The nail was useless. It wouldn't dig the cement properly. I thought it would crumble away. It was terribly hard. I took hours to get one stone out. There wasn't earth behind, but another stone. A bigger one. chalk. And I couldn't even find where its edge was. I got another stone out of the wall, but it didn't help. There was the same huge stone behind. I began to get desperate. I saw the tunnel was no good. I hit violently at the door. I tried to force it with the nail and managed to hurt my hand. That's all. All I had at the end was a sore hand and broken fingernails. I'm just not strong enough without tools, even with tools. In the end, I put the stones back and powdered as well as I could the cement and mixed it with water and talcum powder to camouflage the hole. It's typical of the states I get in here. I suddenly told myself that the digging would have to be done over a number of days. The only stupid thing was to expect to do it all in one. So I spent a long time trying to hide the place. But it was no good. Little bits fell out. And I'd started in the most obvious place where he's bound to spot it. So I gave up. I suddenly decided it was all petty, stupid, useless, like a bad drawing. Unrescuable. When he came at last, he saw it at once. He always sniffs round as soon as he enters. Then he started to see how far I'd gone. I sat on the bed and watched him. In the end, I threw the nail at him. He cemented the stones back. He says it's solid chalk behind, all the way round. I wouldn't speak to him all the evening. Or look at the things he'd bought, even though I could see one of them was a picture frame. I took a sleeping pill and went to bed straight after supper. Then, this morning, I woke up early. Before he came down, I decided to pass it off as something unimportant, to be normal. Not to give in. I unpacked all the things he'd bought. First of all, there was GP's picture. It's a drawing of a girl, young woman, a nude, like anything else of his I've seen. And I think it must be something he did a long time ago. It is his. It has his simplicity of line. Hatred of fussiness. Of Topolskyitis. She's half turned away, hanging up or taking down a dress from a hook. A pretty face? It's difficult to say. Rather a heavy, myol body. It's not worth dozens of things he's done since. But real. I kissed it when I unwrapped it. I've been looking at some of the lines, not as lines, but as things he's touched, all morning now. Not love. Humanity. Caliban was surprised that I seemed so positively gay when he came in. I thanked him for all he'd bought. I said, "You can't be a proper prisoner if you don't try to escape. And now, don't let's talk about it. Agreed?" He said that he'd telephoned every gallery I gave him the name of. There was only the one thing. "Thank you very much," I said. "May I keep it down here? And when I go, I'll give it to you." "I shan't." He said he'd rather have a drawing of mine in any case. I asked him if he'd posted the letter. He said he had, but I saw he was going red. I told him I believed him, and that it would be such a dirty trick not to post the letter that I was sure he must have posted it. I feel almost certain he funked it, as he funked the check. It would be just like him. But nothing I say will make him post it. So I've decided that I will suppose he has posted it. Midnight. I had to stop. He came down. We'd been playing the records he bought. Bartok's Music for Percussion and Celeste. The loveliest. It made me think of Collioure. Last summer, the day we went, all four of us with the French students, up through the ilexes to the tower. The ilexes, an absolutely new colour. Amazing chestnut, rufous, burning, bleeding where they had cut away the cork. The cicadas, the wild azure sea through the stems and the heat and the smell of everything burnt in it. Piers and I and everyone except Minnie got a bit tipsy. Sleeping in the shade, waking up, staring through the leaves at the cobalt blue sky, thinking how impossible things were to paint. How can some blue pigment ever mean the living blue light of the sky? I suddenly felt I didn't want to paint. Painting was just showing off. The thing was to experience, and experience forevermore. The beautiful, clean sun, on the blood-red stems. And coming back, I had a long talk with the nice, shy boy, Jean-Louis. His bad English and my bad French, yet we understood each other. Terribly timid he was, frightened of Piers. Jealous of him. Jealous of his throwing an arm round me. The silly lad Piers is. And when I discovered he was going to be a priest. Piers was so crude afterwards. That stupid, clumsy, frightened of being soft English male cruelty to the truth. He couldn't see that of course poor Jean-Louis liked me. Of course he was sexually attracted, but there was this other thing. It wasn't really shyness, it was a determination to try to be a priest and to live in the world. A simply colossal effort of coming to terms with oneself. Like destroying all the paintings one's ever done and making a new start. Only he had to do it every day. Every time he saw a girl he liked. And all Piers could say was, I bet he's having dirty dreams about you. So ghastly, that arrogance, that insensitivity of boys who've been to public schools. Piers is always going on about how he hated Stowe, as if that solves everything, as if to hate something means it can't have affected you. I always know when he doesn't understand something. He gets cynical. He says something shocking. When I told GP about it much later, he just said, poor frog. He was probably on his knees praying to forget you. Watching Piers throw stones out to sea. Where was it? Somewhere near Valencia. So beautiful. Like a young god. All golden brown with his dark hair. His swimming slip. And Minnie said, she was lying beside me, oh, it's so clear. She said, wouldn't it be wonderful if Piers was dumb? And then she said, could you go to bed with him? I said, no. Then, I don't know. Piers came up just then and wanted to know what she was smiling about. Nanda's just told me a secret, she said. About you. Piers made some feeble joke and went off to get the lunch from the car with Peter. What's the secret, I wanted to know. Bodies beat minds, she said. Clever Carmen Gray always knows what to say. I knew you'd say that, she said. She was doodling in the sand, and I was on my tummy watching her. She said, what I mean is he's so terribly good-looking, one could forget he's so stupid. You might think I could marry him and teach him, couldn't you? And you know you couldn't. Or you could go to bed with him just for fun, and one day you'd suddenly find you were in love with his body, and you couldn't live without it, and you'd be stuck with his rotten mind forever and ever. And then she said, doesn't it terrify you? Not more than so many other things. I'm serious. If you married him, I'd never speak to you again. And she was serious. That very quick, grey, shy look she puts on like a little lance. I got up and kissed her on the way up and went to meet the boys. And she sat there, still looking down at the sand. We're both terrible lookers through. We can't help it. But she's always said, I believe this. I shall act like this. It's got to be someone you at least feel is your equal, who can look through as well as you. And the body thing's always got to be second. And I've always secretly thought, Carmen will be another spinster. It's too complicated for set ideas. But now I think of GP, and I compare him to Piers. And Piers has got nothing on his side. Just a golden body, throwing stones aimlessly into the sea. November 5th. I gave him hell tonight. I started throwing things around upstairs. First cushions and then plates. I've been longing to break them. But I was beastly, really. Spoilt. He suffered it all. He's so weak. He ought to have slapped me across the face. He did catch hold of me to stop me breaking another of his wretched plates. He so rarely touch. I hated it. It was like icy water. I lectured him. I told him all about himself and what he ought to do in life, but he doesn't listen. He likes me to talk about him. It doesn't matter what I say. I won't write any more. I'm reading Sense and Sensibility, and I must find out what happens to Marianne. Marianne is me. Eleanor is me, as I ought to be. What happens if he has a crash? A stroke? Anything. I die. I couldn't get out. All I did the day before yesterday was to prove it. November 6th. It's afternoon. No lunch. Another escape. So nearly, it seemed at one point. But it never was. He's a devil. I tried the appendicitis trick. I thought of it weeks ago. I've always thought of it as a last resort. Something I must not bungle through unpreparedness. I didn't write about it here, in case he found this. I rubbed talc into my face. Then, when he knocked on the door this morning, I swallowed a whole lot of saved-up salt and water and pressed my tongue, and the timing was perfect. He came in and was sick. I put on a tremendous act. Lying on the bed with my hair in a mess and holding my tummy, still in my pyjamas and dressing gown, groaning a little as if I was being terribly bred. All the time he stood and said, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" We had a sort of desperate, broken conversation, Caliban trying to get out of taking me to hospital and I insisting that he must. And then suddenly he seemed to give way. He muttered something about it being the end and rushed out. I heard the iron door go. I was still staring at the wall, but no bolts. Then the outer door. And there was silence. It was weird. So sudden. So complete. Yes, it worked. I pulled on some socks and shoes and ran to the iron door. It had sprung back an inch or two. It was open. I thought it might be all a trap. So I kept up the act. I opened the door and said his name in a quiet voice and hobbled weakly across the cellar and up the steps. I could see the light. He hadn't locked the outer door either. It flashed across my mind that it was just what he would do. He wouldn't go to the doctor. He'd run away, crack up completely, but he'd take the van. So I would hear the engine. But I couldn't. I must have waited several minutes. I should have known, but I couldn't bear the suspense. I pulled the door open and rushed out. And he was there. At once. In all the daylight. I couldn't pretend I was ill. I put shoes on. He had something, a hammer in his hand. Peculiar, wide eyes. I'm sure he was going to attack me. We sort of stood poised for a moment, neither of us knowing what to do. Then I turned and ran back. I don't know why. I didn't stop to think. He came after me, but he stopped when he saw me go inside, as I instinctively knew he would. The only safe place from him was down here. I heard him come, and the bolts were shot too. I know it was the right thing to do. It saved my life. If I'd screamed or tried to escape, he would have battered me to death. There are moments when he's possessed, quite out of his own control. His trick. Midnight. He brought me supper down here. He didn't say a word. I'd spent the afternoon doing a strip cartoon of him. The awful tale of a harmless boy. Absurd. But I have to keep the reality and the horror at bay. He starts by being a nice little clerk and ends up as a drooling horror film monster. When he was going, I showed it to him. He didn't laugh. He simply looked at it carefully. "It's only natural," he said. He meant that I should make such fun of him. I'm one in a row of specimens. It's when I try to flutter out of line that he hates me. I'm meant to be dead, pinned, always the same, always beautiful. He knows that part of my beauty is being alive, but it's the dead me he wants. He wants me living but dead. I felt it terribly strongly today. That my being alive and changing and having a separate mind and having moods and all that was becoming a nuisance. He is solid. Immovable, iron-willed. He showed me one day what he called his killing bottle. I'm imprisoned in it, fluttering against the glass. Because I can see through it, I still think I can escape. I have hope. that it's all an illusion. A thick, round wall of glass. November 7th. How the days drag. Today. Intolerably long. My one consolation is GP's drawing. It grows on me. On one. It's the only living, unique, created thing here. It's the first thing I look at when I wake up. The last thing at night. I stand in front of it and stare at it. I know every line. He made a fudge of one of her feet. There's something slightly unbalanced about the whole composition, as if there's a tiny bit missing somewhere. But it lives. After supper, we're back to normal. Caliban handed me The Catcher in the Rye and said, I've read it. I knew at once by his tone that he meant, and I don't think much of it. I feel awake. I'll do a dialogue. Well, I don't see much point in it. You realize this is one of the most brilliant studies of adolescence ever written. He sounds a mess to me. Of course he's a mess. But he realizes he's a mess. He tries to express what he feels. He's a human being for all his faults. Don't you even feel sorry for him? I don't like the way he talks. I don't like the way you talk. But I don't treat you as below any serious notice or sympathy. I suppose it's very clever to write like that and all. I gave you that book to read because I thought you would feel identified with him. You're a Holden Caulfield. He doesn't fit anywhere and you don't. I don't wonder the way he goes on. Doesn't try to fit. He tries to construct some sort of reality in his life, some sort of decency. Ah, it's not realistic going to a posh school and his parents having money. He wouldn't behave like that, in my opinion. I know what you are. You're the old man of the sea. Who's he? The horrid old man Sinbad had to carry on his back. That's what you are. You get on the back of everything vital, everything trying to be honest and free, and you bear it down. I won't go on. We argued. No, we don't argue. I say things and he tries to wriggle out of them. It's true. He is the old man of the sea. I can't stand stupid people like Caliban, with their great dead weight of pettiness and selfishness and meanness of every kind. And the few have to carry it all. The doctors and the teachers and the artists. Not that they haven't their traitors. But what hope there is with them. With us. Because I'm one of them. I'm one of them. I feel it and I've tried to prove it. I felt it during my last year at Ladymont. There were the few of us who cared, and there were the silly ones, the snobbish ones, the would-be debutantes, and the daddy's darlings, and the horsophiles, and the sex cats. I'll never go back to Ladymont, because I couldn't stand that suffocating atmosphere of the done thing and the right people and the nice behaviour. Boadicea writing in spite of her weird political views on my report. How dared she? I will not be an old girl of such a place. Why should we tolerate their beastly Calibanity? Why should every vital and creative and good person be martyred by the great universal stodge around? In this situation, I'm a representative. A martyr. Imprisoned. Unable to grow. At the mercy of this resentment. This hateful millstone envy of the Calibans of this world. Because they all hate us. They hate us for being different. For not being them. For their own not being like us. They persecute us. They crowd us out. They send us to Coventry. They sneer at us. They yawn at us. They blindfold themselves and stuff up their ears. They do anything to avoid having to take notice of us and respect us. They go crawling after the great ones among us when they're dead. They pay thousands and thousands for the Van Goghs and Modiglianis they'd have spat on at the time they were painted. Guffawed at. Made coarse jokes about. I hate them. I hate the uneducated and the ignorant. I hate the pompous and the phony. I hate the jealous and the resentful. I hate the crabbed and the mean and the petty. I hate all ordinary, dull little people who aren't ashamed of being dull and little. I hate what GP calls the new people.
The new class people with their cars and their money and their tellies and their stupid vulgarities and their stupid, crawling imitation of the bourgeoisie. I love honesty and freedom and giving. I love making. I love doing. I love being to the full. I love everything which is not sitting and watching and copying and dead at heart. GP was laughing at my being Labour one day, early on. I remember he said, "You're supporting the party which brought the new people into existence. Do you realise that?" I said, I was shocked, because from what he'd said about other things, I thought he must be Labour. I knew he'd been a communist once. I'd rather we had the new people than poor people. He said, "The new people are still the poor people. Theirs is the new form of poverty. The others hadn't any money, and these haven't any soul." He suddenly said, "Have you read Major Barbara? How it proved people had to be saved financially before you could save their souls." "They forgot one thing," he said. "They brought in the welfare state, but they forgot Barbara herself. Affluence, affluence, and not a soul to see." No, he's wrong somewhere. He was exaggerating. One must be on the left. Every decent person I've ever met has been anti-Tory. But I see what he feels. I mean, I feel it myself more and more. This awful dead weight of the fat little new people on everything. Corrupting everything. Vulgarizing everything. Raping the countryside, as Dee says in his squire moods. Everything mass-produced. Mass everything. I know we're supposed to face the herd. Control the stampede, it's like a Wild West film. Work for them, and tolerate them. I shall never go to the Ivory Tower. That's the most despicable thing, to choose to leave life because it doesn't suit you. But sometimes it is frightening, thinking of the struggle life is, if one takes it seriously. All this is talk. Probably I shall meet someone and fall in love with him and marry him, and things will seem to change and I shan't care any more. I shall become a little woman. One of the enemy. But this is what I feel these days. That I belong to a sort of band of people who have to stand against all the rest. I don't know who they are. Famous men, dead and living, who fought for the right things and created and painted in the right way, and unfamous people I know who don't lie about things, who try not to be lazy, who try to be human and intelligent. Yes, people like GP, for all his faults. His fault. They're not even good people. They have weak moments. Sex moments and drink moments. Coward and money moments. They have holidays in the Ivory Tower. But a part of them is one with the band. The few. November 9th. I'm vain. I'm not one of them. I want to be one of them. And that's not the same thing. Of course, Caliban is not typical of the new people. He's hopelessly out of date. He will call the record player the gramophone. And there's his lack of confidence. They're not ashamed of themselves. I remember Dee saying they think they're all equal to the best as soon as they have a telly and a car. But deep down, Caliban's one of them. There's this hatred of the unusual, this wanting everybody to be the same, and the awful misuse of money. Why should people have money if they don't know how to use it? It sickens me every time I think of all the money Caliban has won, and of all the other people like him who win money. So selfish, so evil. GP said that day, "The honest poor are the moneyless, vulgar rich. Poverty forces them to have good qualities and pride in other things besides money. Then, when they have money, they don't know what to do with it. They forget all the old virtues, which weren't real virtues anyway. They think the only virtue is to make more money and to spend. They can't imagine that there are people to whom money is nothing, that the most beautiful things are quite independent of money." I'm not being frank. I still want money. But I know that's wrong. I believe GP. I don't have to believe him when he says it. I can see it's true. He hardly worries about money at all. He has just enough to buy his materials to live, to have a working holiday every year, to manage. And there are a dozen others. Peter, Bill MacDonald, Stefan. They don't live in the world of money. If they have it, they spend it. If they don't, they go without. Persons like Caliban have no head for money. They've only got to have a little like the new people, and they become beastly. All the horrid people who wouldn't give me money when I was collecting, I could tell, I only had to look in their faces. Bourgeois people give because they're embarrassed if you pester them. Intelligent people give, or at least they look honestly at you and say no. They're not ashamed not to give. But the new people are too mean to give and too small to admit it. Like the horrid man in Hampstead, he was one of them who said, "I'll give you half a dollar if you can prove it doesn't go into someone's pocket." He thought he was being funny. I turned my back on him, which was wrong, because my pride was less important than the children. So I put a half crown in for him later. But I still hate him. With Caliban, it's as if somebody made him drink a whole bottle of whiskey. He can't take it. The only thing that kept him decent before was being poor, being stuck to one place and job. It's like putting a blind man in a fast car and telling him to drive where and how he likes. A nice thing to end with. The Bach record came today. I've played it twice already. Caliban said it was nice, but he wasn't musical. However, he sat with the right sort of expression on his face. I'm going to play the parts I like again. I'm going to lie in bed in the darkness and the music and think I'm with GP. And he's lying over there with his eyes shut and his pitted cheek and his Jew's nose, as if he was on his own tomb, only there's nothing of death in him. Even so, this evening, Caliban was late coming down. "Where have you been?" I snapped at him. He just looked surprised, said nothing. I said, "You seem so late." I often want him to come. I'm as lonely as that. November 10th. We had an argument this evening about his money. I said he ought to give most of it away. I tried to shame him into giving some away. But he won't trust anything. That's what's really wrong with him. Like my man in Hampstead, he doesn't trust people to collect money and use it for the purpose they say they will. He thinks everyone is corrupt. Everyone tries to get money and keep it. It's no good my saying I know it's used for the right purpose. He says, "Well, how do you know?" And of course I can't tell him. I can only say I feel sure it must go where it's needed. And then he smiles as if I'm too naive to have any right on my side. I accused him, not very bitterly, of not having sent the CND check. I challenged him to produce a receipt. He said the gift was anonymous. He hadn't sent his address. It was on the tip of my tongue to say, "I shall go and find out when I'm free." But I didn't, because it would be one more reason for him not to set me free. He was red. I'm sure he was lying, as he lied about the letter to D&M. It's not so much a lack of generosity, a real miserliness. He spends hundreds of pounds on me. He'd kill me with kindness, with chocolates and cigarettes and food and flowers. I said I'd like some French perfume the other evening. It was just a whim, really, but this room smells of disinfectant and air wick. I have enough baths, but I don't feel clean. And I said I wished I could go and sniff the various scents to see which I liked best. He came in this morning with 14 different bottles. He'd ransacked all the chemist's shops. It's mad. £40 worth. It's like living in the Arabian Nights, being the favourite in the harem. But the one perfume you really want is freedom. If I could put a starving child before him and give it food and let him watch it grow well, I know he'd give money. But everything beyond what he pays for and sees himself get is suspicious to him. He doesn't believe in any other world but the one he lives in and sees. He's the one in prison, in his own hateful, narrow, present world. November 12th. The last night but one. I daren't think about it. about not escaping. I've kept reminding him recently, but now I feel I should have sprung it on him more or less suddenly. Today I decided that I would organize a little party tomorrow night. I shall say I feel differently towards him, that I want to be his friend and lame-duck him in London. It won't be altogether a lie. I feel a responsibility towards him that I don't really understand. I so often hate him. I think I ought to forever hate him, yet I don't always. My pity wins, and I do want to help him. I think of people I could introduce him to. He could go to Caroline's psychiatrist friend. I'd be like Emma and arrange a marriage for him, and with happier results. Some little Harriet Smith, with whom he could be mousy and sane and happy. I know I have to steel myself against not being freed. I tell myself it's a chance in 100 that he'll keep his word. But he must keep his word.
End of side 13. Side 14.
GP. I hadn't seen him for 2 months, more than 2 months. Being in France and Spain and then at home, I did try to see him twice, but he was away all September. There was a postcard in answer to my letters. That was all. I telephoned him and asked him if I could go round. The first evening I was back with Caroline. He said the next day there were some people there that evening. He seemed glad to see me. I was trying to look as if I hadn't tried to look pretty. I had. And I told him all about France and Spain and the Goyas and Albi and everything else, Piers. And he listened. He wouldn't really say what he'd been doing, but later he showed me some of the things he'd done in the Hebrides. And I felt ashamed. Because we'd none of us done much. We'd been too busy lying in the sun, I mean too lazy, and looking at great pictures to do much drawing or anything. I said, having gushed for at least an hour, I'm talking too much. He said, I don't mind. He was getting the rust off an old iron wheel with some acid. He'd seen it in a junk shop in Edinburgh and brought it all the way down. It had strange, obtuse teeth. He thought it was part of an old church clock. Very elegant, tapered spoke arms. It was beautiful. We didn't say anything for a while. I was leaning beside him against his bench, watching him clean off the rust. And then he said, I've missed you. I said, you can't have. He said, you've disturbed me. I said, night to cover his pawn. Have you seen Antoinette? He said, no. I thought I told you I gave her the boot. He looked sideways, his lizard look. Still shocked, I shook my head. Forgiven? I said, there was nothing to forgive. He said, I kept on thinking about you in the Hebrides. I wanted to show you things. I said, I wished you were with us in Spain. He was busy, emery papering between the teeth. He said, it's very old. Look at this corrosion. And then in the same tone, in fact, I decided that I want to marry you. I didn't say anything, and I wouldn't look at him. He said, I asked you to come here when I was alone because I've been thinking quite hard about this. I'm twice your age. I ought to take things like this in my stride. Christ only knows it's not the first time. No, let me finish now. I've decided I've got to stop seeing you. I was going to tell you that when you came in. I can't go on being disturbed by you. I shall be if you keep on coming here. This isn't a roundabout way of asking you to marry me, to make it quite impossible. You know what I am. You know I'm old enough to be your father. I'm not reliable at all. Anyhow, you don't love me. I said, I can't explain it. There isn't a word for it. Precisely, he answered. He was cleaning his hands with petrol, very clinical and matter-of-fact. So, I have to ask you to leave me to find my peace again. I stared at his hands. I was shocked. He said, in some ways, you're older than I am.
You've never been deeply in love. Perhaps you never will be. He said, love goes on happening to you, to men. Oh, you become 20 again. You suffer as 20 suffers. All the dotty irrationalities of 20. I may seem very reasonable at the moment, but I don't feel it. When you telephoned, I nearly peed in my pants with excitement. I'm an old man in love. Stock comedy figure. Very stale. Not even funny. Why do you think I'll never be deeply in love? I said. He took a terribly long time to clean his hands. He said, I said, perhaps. I'm only just 20. He said, an ash tree a foot high is still an ash tree. But I did say perhaps. And you're not old. It's nothing to do with our ages. He gave me a faintly hurt look then, smiled and said, you must leave me some loophole. We went to make coffee, the wretched little kitchen, and I thought, anyhow, I couldn't face up to living here with him. Just the domestic effort. A vile, irrelevant wave of bourgeois cowardice. He said with his back to me, until you went away, I thought it was just the usual thing. At least I tried to think it was. That's why I misbehaved myself with your Swedish friend. To exercise you. But you came back, in my mind, again and again up north. I used to go out of the farmhouse at night into the garden. Look south. You do understand? Yes, I said. It was you, you see. Not just the other thing. And then he said, oh, it's a sudden look you have. When you're not a kid anymore. What sort of look? The woman will be, he said. A nice woman? A much more than nice woman. There's no word to say how he said it. Sadly, almost unwillingly. Tenderly, but a shade bitterly. And honestly, not teasing, not being dry, but right out of his real self. I'd been looking down all the time we were talking, but he made me look up then. And our eyes met. And I know something passed between us. I could feel it, almost a physical touch, changing us. His saying something he totally meant, and my feeling it. He remained staring at me, so that I was embarrassed, and still he stared. I said, please, don't stare at me like that. He came and put his arm round my shoulders then, and led me gently towards the door. He said, you're very pretty, at times. You're beautiful. You're sensitive, you're eager, you try to be honest. You manage to be both your age and natural and a little priggish and old-fashioned at the same time. You even play chess quite well. You're just the daughter I'd like to have. That's probably why I've wanted you so much these last few months. He pushed me through the door, face forward so I couldn't see him. I can't say such things to you without turning your head. And you mustn't turn your head in any sense. Now, go. I felt him press my shoulders an instant. And he kissed the back of my head, pushed me away. And I went 2 or 3 steps down the stairs before I stopped and looked back. He was smiling, but it was a sad smile. I said, please don't let it be too long. He just shook his head. I don't know if he meant, no, not too long. Or, it's no good hoping it will be anything else but very long. Perhaps he didn't know himself. But he looked sad. He looked sad all through. Of course, I looked sad, but I didn't really feel sad. Or it wasn't a sadness that hurt, not an all-through one. I rather enjoyed it. Beastly, but I did. I sang on the way home. The romance, the mystery of it. Living. I thought I knew I didn't love him. I'd won that game. And what has happened since? That first day or two, I kept on thinking he would telephone, that it was all a sort of whim.
Then I would think, I shan't see him again for months, perhaps years, and it seems ridiculous, unnecessary, stupid beyond belief. I hated what seemed his weakness. I thought, oh, if he's like this, to hell with him. That didn't last very long. I decided to decide that it was for the best. He was right. It was best to make a clean break. I would concentrate on work, be practical and efficient, and everything that I'm not really by nature. All that time I kept thinking, do I love him? Then, obviously, there was so much doubt, I couldn't. And now, I have to write down what I feel now. Because I've changed again. I know it. I feel it. Looks. I know it's idiotically wrong to have preconceived notions about looks. Getting excited when Piers kisses me. Having to stare at him sometimes, not when he would notice because of his vanity, but feeling his looks intensely. Like a beautiful drawing of something ugly. You forget about the ugliness. I know Piers is morally and psychologically ugly. Just plain and dull, phony. But even there I've changed. I think about GP holding me and caressing me. There's a sort of nasty, perverted curiosity in me. I mean, all the women he's had and all the things he must know about being in bed. I can imagine his making love to me, and it doesn't disgust me. Very expert and gentle. Fun. All sorts of things. But not the thing. If it's to be for life. Then there's his weakness. The feeling that he would probably betray me. And I've always thought of marriage as a sort of young adventure. Two people of the same age getting out together, discovering together, growing together. But I would have nothing to tell him. Nothing to show him. All the helping would be on his side. I've seen so little of the world. I know that GP in many ways represents a sort of ideal now. His sense of what counts. His independence. His refusal to do what the others do. His standing apart. It has to be someone with those qualities. And no one else I've met has them as he has. People at the Slade seem to have them, but they're so young. It's easy to be frank and to hell with convention when you're our age. Once or twice I've wondered whether it wasn't all a trap. Like a sacrifice in chess, supposing I'd said on the stairs, do what you like with me, but don't send me away. No, I won't believe that of him. Time lag. 2 years ago, I couldn't have dreamed of falling in love with an older man. I was always the one who argued for equal ages at Ladymont. I remembered being one of the most disgusted when Susan Grillet married a beastly baronet nearly three times her age. Minnie and I used to talk about guarding against being father types, because of M, and marrying father husbands. But now, I think I need a man older than myself, because I always seem to see through the boys I meet. And I don't feel GP is a father husband. It's no good. I could go on writing arguments for and against all night. Emma, the business of being between inexperienced girl and experienced woman, the awful problem of the man. Caliban is Mr. Elton. Piers is Frank Churchill. But is GP Mr. Knightley? Of course, GP has lived a life and has views that would make Mr. Knightley turn in his grave. But Mr. Knightley could never have been a phony, because he was a hater of pretense. Selfishness, snobbism. And they both have the one man's name I really can't stand. George. Perhaps there's a moral in that. November 18th. I've eaten nothing for 5 days. I've drunk some water. He brings me food, but I've touched not one crumb. Tomorrow, I'm going to start eating again. About half an hour ago, I stood up and I felt faint. I had to sit down again. I haven't felt ill so far. Just tummy pains and a bit weak. But this was something different. A warning. I'm not going to die for him. I haven't needed food. I've been so full of hatred for him and his beastliness. His vile cowardice. His selfishness,
His Calibanity!
November 19th. For all that time, I didn't want to write. Sometimes I wanted to. Then it seemed weak, like accepting things. I knew as soon as I wrote it down I'd go off the boil. But now I think it needs writing down, recording. He did this to me. Outrage! What little friendship, humanity, good nature there was between us has gone. From now on we're enemies, both ways. He said things that showed he hates me as well. He resents my existence, that's exactly it. He doesn't really fully yet, because he's trying to be nice to me at the moment, but he's much nearer than he was. One day soon he's going to wake up and say to himself, I hate her. Something nasty. When I came round from the chloroform, I was in bed. I had my last underclothes on, but he must have taken everything else off. I was furious that first night, mad with disgust, his beastly gloating hands touching me, peeling my stockings off. Loathsome. Then I thought of what he might have done, and hadn't. I decided not to fly at him, but silence. To shout at someone suggests that there's still contact. Since then, I've thought two things. First, he'd weird enough to have undressed me without thinking, according to some mad notion of the proper thing to do. Perhaps he thought I couldn't lie in bed with my clothes on. And then, that perhaps it was a sort of reminder of all the things he might have done but hadn't. His chivalry. And I accept that. I've been lucky. But I even find it frightening that he didn't do anything. What is he? There's a great rift between us now. It can never be bridged. He says now he will release me in another 4 weeks. Just talk. I don't believe him. So I've warned him I'm going to try to kill him. I would now. I wouldn't think twice about it. I've seen how Rob was before. How blind. I prostituted myself to Caliban. I mean, I let him spend all that money on me, and although I told myself it was fair, it wasn't, because I felt vaguely grateful. I'd been nice to him. Even my teasing was nice, even my sneering and spitting at him, even my breaking things, because it takes notice of him. And my attitude should have been what it will be from now on. Ice. Freeze him to death. He's absolutely inferior to me in all ways. His one superiority is his ability to keep me here. That's the only power he has. He can't behave, or think, or speak, or do anything else better than can, nearly as well as I can. So he's going to be the old man of the sea until I shake him off somehow. It'll have to be by force. I've been sitting here and thinking about God. I don't think I believe in God anymore. It's not only me. I think of all the millions who must have lived like this in the war. The Anne Franks. And back through history. What I feel I know now is that God doesn't intervene. He lets us suffer. If you pray for liberty, then you may get relief just because you pray, or because things happen anyhow which bring you liberty. But God can't hear. There's nothing human like hearing, or seeing, or pitying, or helping about him. I mean, perhaps God has created the world and the fundamental laws of matter and evolution, but he can't care about the individuals. He's planned it so some individuals are happy, some sad, some lucky, some not. Who is sad? Who is not? He doesn't know, and he doesn't care. So he doesn't exist, really. These last few days I felt godless. I felt cleaner, less muddled, less blind. I still believe in a God, but he's so remote, so cold, so mathematical. I see that we have to live as if there is no God. Prayer and worship and singing hymns, all silly and useless. I'm trying to explain why I'm breaking with my principles about never committing violence. It is still my principle, but I see you have to break principles sometimes to survive. It's no good trusting vaguely in your luck, in providence, or God's being kind to you. You have to act and fight for yourself. The sky is absolutely empty. Beautifully pure and empty. As if the architects and builders would live in all the houses they've built. Or could live in them all. It's obvious. It stares you in the face. There must be a God, and he can't know anything about us. Same evening. I've been very mean with him all day. Several times he's tried to speak, but I've shut him up. Did I want him to bring me anything? I said, I want nothing. I'm your prisoner. If you give me food, I shall eat it to keep alive. Our relations from now on, strictly those of a prisoner and a warder. Now please, leave me alone. Luckily, I've plenty to read. He'll go on bringing me cigarettes, and if he doesn't, I shan't ask him for them. And food. That's all I want from him. He's not human. He's an empty space, disguised as a human.
November 20th.
I'm making him wish he never set eyes on me. He brought in some baked beans for lunch. I was reading on the bed. He stood for a moment and then started to go out. I jumped to the table, picked up the plate and hurled it at him. I don't like baked beans. He knows it. I suppose he'd been lazy. I wasn't in a temper. I just pretended. He stood there with the filthy little bits of orange sauce on his so-clean clothes and looked sheepish. I don't want any lunch, I snapped him, and turned my back. I ate chocolates all the afternoon. He didn't reappear until supper time. There was caviar, and smoked salmon, and cold chicken. He buys them ready cooked somewhere. All things he knows I like. And a dozen other things he knows I like, the cunning brute. It's not the buying them that's cunning. It's just that I can't help being grateful. I didn't actually say I was grateful, but I wasn't sharp. It's that he presents them so humbly, with such an air of, please don't thank me, and I deserve it all. When he was arranging my supper things on the table, I had an irresistible desire to giggle. Awful. I wanted to collapse on the bed and scream. He was so perfectly himself, and I am so cooped up. Down here my moods change so rapidly. All determination to do one thing one hour, all for another the next. It's no use. I'm not a hater by nature. It's as if somewhere in me a certain amount of goodwill and kindness is manufactured every day, and it must come out. If I bottle it up, then it bursts out. I wasn't nice to him. I don't want to be nice to him. I shan't be nice to him. But it was a struggle not to be ordinary to him. I mean little things like, that was a nice meal. As it was, I said nothing. And when he said, will that be all? Like a butler. I said, yes, you can go now. And turned my back. He would have got a shock if he could have seen my face. It was smiling. And when he shut the door, I was laughing. I couldn't help it again. Hysteria! Something I've been doing a lot these last days, staring at myself in the mirror. Sometimes I don't seem real to myself. It suddenly seems that it isn't my reflection only a foot or two away. I have to look aside. I look all over my face and my eyes. I try to see what my eyes say, what I am, why I'm here. It's because I'm so lonely. I have to look at an intelligent face. Anyone who's been locked away like this would understand. You become very real to yourself in a strange way, as you never were before. So much of you is given to ordinary people, suppressed in ordinary life. I watch my face, and I watch it move as if it's someone else's. I stare myself out. I sit with myself. Sometimes, it's like a sort of spell, and I have to put my tongue out and wrinkle my nose to break it. I sit down here in the absolute silence with my reflection in a sort of state of mystery, in a trance.
November 21st. It's the middle of the night. I can't sleep.
I hate myself. I nearly became a murderess tonight.
I shall never be the same again.
It's difficult to write. My hands are bound. I've got the gag off. It all began at lunch. I realized that I was having a struggle not to be nice to him. Because I felt I must talk to someone. Even him. At least he's a human being. When he went away after lunch, I wanted to call him back to talk.
What I felt was quite different from what I decided I should feel 2 days ago, so I made a new decision. I could never hit him with anything down here. I've watched him so much with that in mind, and he never turns his back to me. Besides, there's no weapon. So I thought, I've got to get upstairs and find something, some means. I had several ideas. Otherwise, I was afraid I would fall into the old trap of pitying him. So I was a bit nicer at supper time and said I needed a bath, which I did. He went away, came back, and we went up. And there, it seemed a sign, specially left for me, was a small axe. It was on the kitchen windowsill, which is next to the door. He must have been chopping wood outside and forgotten to hide it, my always being down here. We passed indoors too quickly for me to do anything then, but I lay in the bath and thought. I decided it must be done. I had to catch up the axe and hit him with the blunt end, knock him out. I hadn't the least idea where on the head was the best place to hit or how hard it had to be. Then I asked to go straight back. As we went out through the kitchen door, I dropped my talcum powder and things and stood to one side towards the windowsill as if I was looking to see where they'd gone. He did just what I wanted and bent forward to pick them up. I wasn't nervous. I picked the axe up very neatly. I didn't scrape the blade, and it was the blunt end. But then, it was like waking up out of a bad dream. I had to hit him, and I couldn't. But I had to. Then he began to straighten up. All this happened in a flash, really, and I did hit him. But he was turning, and I didn't hit straight, or hard enough. I mean, I lashed out in a panic at the last moment. He fell sideways. But I knew he wasn't knocked out. He still kept hold of me. I suddenly felt I had to kill him, or he would kill me. I hit him again, but he had his arm up. At the same time, he kicked out and knocked me off my feet. Oh, it was too horrible, panting, straining like animals. And suddenly I knew it. I don't know. Undignified. It sounds absurd, but that was it. Like a statue lying on its side. Like a fat woman trying to get up off the grass. We got up. He pushed me roughly towards the door, keeping a tight hold of me. But that was all. I had a funny feeling it was the same for him. Disgusting. I thought someone may have heard, even though I couldn't call out, but it was windy. Wet and cold. No one would have been out. I'd been lying on the bed. I soon stopped crying. I'd been lying for hours in the dark and thinking. November 22nd. I'm ashamed. I let myself down vilely. I've come to a series of decisions, thoughts. Violence and force are wrong. If I use violence, I descend to his level. It means that I have no real belief in the power of reason and sympathy and humanity. That I lame duck people only because it flatters me, not because I believe they need my sympathy. I've been thinking back to Ladymont, to people I lame ducked there. Sally Margeson. I lame ducked her just to show the Vestal Virgins that I was cleverer than they. That I could get her to do things for me that she wouldn't do for them. Donald and Piers. Because I've lame-ducked him in a sense, too. But they're both attractive young men. There were probably hundreds of other people who needed lame-ducking my sympathy far more than those two. And anyway, most girls would have jumped at the chance of lame-ducking them. I've given up too soon with Caliban. I've got to take up a new attitude with him. The prisoner-warder idea was silly. I won't spit at him anymore. I'll be silent when he irritates me. I'll treat him as someone who needs all my sympathy and understanding. I'll go on trying to teach him things about art. Other things. There's only one way to do things. The right way. Not what they meant by the right way at Ladymont, but the way you feel is right. My own right way. I am a moral person. I'm not ashamed of being moral.
I will not let Caliban make me immoral, even though he deserves all my hatred and bitterness and an axe in his head. Later. I've been nice to him. That is, not the cat I've been lately. As soon as he came in, I made him let me look at his head, and I dabbed some Dettol on it. He was nervous. I make him jumpy. He doesn't trust me. That is precisely the state I shouldn't have got him into. It's difficult, though. When I'm being beastly to him, he has such a way of looking sorry for himself that I begin to hate myself. But as soon as I begin to be nice to him, a sort of self-satisfaction seems to creep into his voice and his manner. Very discreet, he's been humility itself all day. No reproach about last night, of course. And I begin to want to gold and slap him again. A tightrope. But it's cleared the air. Night. I tried to teach him what to look for in abstract art after supper. It's hopeless. He has it fixed in his poor dim noddle that art is fiddling away. He can't understand why I don't rub out until you get an exact photographic likeness and that making lovely, cool designs, Ben Nicholson, is vaguely immoral. I can see it makes a nice pattern, he said. But he won't concede that making a nice pattern is art. With him, it's that certain words have terribly strong undertones. Everything to do with art embarrasses him, and I suppose fascinates him. It's all vaguely immoral. He knows great art is great, but great means locked away in museums and spoken about when you want to show off. Living art, modern art, shocks him. You can't talk about it with him because the word art starts off a whole series of shocked, guilty ideas in him. I wish I knew if there were many people like him. Of course, I know the vast majority, especially the new people, don't care a damn about any of the arts. But is it because they are like him? Or because they just couldn't care less? I mean, does it really bore them? So that they don't need it at all in their lives? Or does it secretly shock and dismay them? So that they have to pretend to be bored? November 23rd. I'd just finished Saturday night and Sunday morning. Oh, it shocked me. It shocked me in itself. And it shocked me because of where I am. It shocked me in the same way as Room at the Top shocked me when I read it last year. I know they're very clever. It must be wonderful to be able to write like Alan Sillitoe. Real. Unphony. Saying what you mean. If he was a painter, it would be wonderful. He'd be like John Bradby, much better. He'd be able to set Nottingham down, and it would be wonderful in paint. Because he painted so well, put down what he saw, people would admire him. But it isn't enough to write well. I mean, choose the right words and so on to be a good writer. Because I think Saturday night and Sunday morning is disgusting. I think Arthur Seton is disgusting. And I think the most disgusting thing of all is that Alan Sillitoe doesn't show that he's disgusted by his young man. I think they think young men like that are really rather fine. I hated the way Arthur Seton just doesn't care about anything outside his own little life. He's mean, narrow, selfish, brutal. Because he's cheeky and hates his work and is successful with women, he's supposed to be vital. The only thing I like about him is the feeling that there is something there that could be used for good, if it could be got at. It's the inwardness of such people. They're not caring what happens anywhere else in the world. In life. They're being in a box. Perhaps Alan Sillitoe wanted to attack the society that produces such people. But he doesn't make it clear. I know what he's done. He's fallen in love with what he's painting. He started out to paint it as ugly as it is. But then its ugliness conquered him, and he started trying to cheat. To prettify. It shocked me, too, because of Caliban. I see there's something of Arthur Seton in him. Only in him, it's turned upside down. I mean, he has that hate of other things and other people outside his own type. He has that selfishness.
It's not even an honest selfishness, because he puts the blame on life, and then enjoys being selfish with a free conscience. He's obstinate, too. This has shocked me, because I think everyone now, except us, and we're contaminated, has this selfishness and this brutality. Whether it's hidden, mousy and perverse, or obvious and crude. Religion's as good as dead. There's nothing to hold back the new people. They'll grow stronger and stronger and swamp us. No, they won't. Because of David. Because of people like Alan Sillitoe. It says on the back he was the son of a labourer. I mean, the intelligent new people will always revolt and come across to our side. The new people destroy themselves because they're so stupid. They can never keep the intelligent ones with them, especially the young ones. We want something better than just money and keeping up with the Joneses. But it's a battle. It's like being in a city and being besieged. They're all around. And we've got to hold out. It's a battle between Caliban and myself. He is the new people, and I am the few. I must fight with my weapons, not his. Not selfishness and brutality and shame and resentment. He's worse than the Arthur Seton kind. If Arthur Seton saw a modern statue he didn't like, he'd smash it. But Caliban would drape a tarpaulin round it. I don't know which is worse. But I think Caliban's way is. November 24th. I'm getting desperate to escape. I can't get any relief from drawing or playing records or reading. The burning, burning need I have, all prisoners must have, is for other people. Caliban is only half a person at the best of times. I want to see dozens and dozens of strange faces. Like being terribly thirsty and gulping down glass after glass of water. Exactly like that. I read once that nobody can stand more than 10 years in prison, or more than 1 year of solitary confinement. One just can't imagine what prison is like from outside. You think, well, there'd be lots of time to think and read, it wouldn't be too bad. But it is too bad. It's the slowness of time. I'll swear all the clocks in the world have gone centuries slower since I came here. Oh, I shouldn't complain. This is a luxury prison. And there's his diabolical cunning about the newspapers and radio and so on. I never read the papers very much, or listened to the news. But to be totally cut off, it's so strange. I feel I've lost all my bearings. I spend hours lying on the bed, thinking about how to escape. Endless. November 25th. Afternoon. This morning, I had a talk with him. I got him to sit as a model. Then I asked him what he really wanted me to do. Should I become his mistress? But that shocked him. He went red and said he could buy that in London. I told him he was a Chinese box, and he is. The innermost box is that I should love him, in all ways, with my body, with my mind, respect him and cherish him. It's so utterly impossible. Even if I could overcome the physical thing, how could I ever look in any way but down on him? Battering his head on a stone wall. I don't want to die. I feel full of endurance. I shall always want to survive. I will survive. November 26th. The only unusual thing about him. How he loves me. Ordinary new people couldn't love anything as he loves me. That is, blindly. Absolutely. Like Dante and Beatrice.
He enjoys being hopelessly in love with me.
I expect Dante was the same. Mooning around, knowing it was all quite hopeless, and getting lots of good creative material from the experience. Though, of course, Caliban can't get anything but his own miserable pleasure. People who don't make anything. I hate them. How frightened of dying I was in those first days. I don't want to die because I keep on thinking of the future. I'm desperately curious to know what life will bring to me. What will happen to me? How I'll develop, what I'll be in 5 years' time, in 10, in 30. The man I will marry and the places I will live in and get to know. Children. It isn't just a selfish curiosity. This is the worst possible time in history to die. Space travel, science, the whole world waking up and stretching itself. A new age is beginning. I know it's dangerous, but it's wonderful to be alive in it. I love, I adore my age. I keep on having thoughts today. One was, uncreative men plus opportunity to create equals evil men. Another one was, killing him was breaking my word to what I believe. Some people would say, you're only a drop. Your word breaking is only a drop. It wouldn't matter. But all the evil in the world's made up of little drops. It's silly talking about the unimportance of the little drops. The little drops and the ocean are the same thing.
End of side 14.